Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
That would be the WWE Hall of Famer, Oklahoma's favorite son, Mr. Gerald Briscoe. And this is Best of the Best, where we are going to dissect, analyze, and talk about the greatest, most iconic matches of all time. And we got a great one today.
John, they said it couldn't be done, but this is episode two.
This is episode two. If they'd have seen how long it took us to get on this episode two, every week we have technical problems. We're a couple old guys that like Stadler and Waldorf. We have a hard time getting on Zoom.
Who's that?
Yeah. You're
Abbott Costello is more like it.
I would think so. Which one would I be?
The heavy set one.
That's not nice. That's not nice at all. Hey, we got a great one.
Which one was that, by the way? Was that Abbott? Or Costello?
Abbott was the fat one. Lou Abbott.
They can't say that word, John.
You know, the other one was a great golfer. He played golf with Babe Ruth. I think Costello did. I think so. Maybe the fat one played it. I don't know. You can't say fat.
Oh, John, quit saying that. Episode two, we're going to get knocked off for shaming people. What do they call it now? Shaman or what? Whatever.
What are you talking about?
I'm a shaman.
You're a shaman. No, you just smoke peace pipe. You're not a shaman. Hey, we got a great one today, Mr. Briscoe. Don Eagle versus Gorgeous George, August 31st, 1950. One of the original screw jobs.
You know, and I'm glad you said original, one of the originals, because if we say the first, you know, there ain't nothing the first in this business. You know,
that's
there
right.
Was one somewhere else, you know, but this is one that was done on TV. And John, it just goes back to what we talk about on the Best of the Best is the political attitude during that era. You know, I mean, there were so many different world champions, and the promoters, you know, they just formed the NWA. And even after they formed the NWA, half of promoters was using other people's champions, and that's what the NWA was formed for, to get one wrestling champion, not five or six of them, whatever they had, but one. And that one, you know, after they settled in, after the beginning years with Farmer Brown, Orville Brown, and all those other Browns, they chose Lou Thesz. And Lou was respected, you know, nationwide, and was, you know, Lou was a big athletic guy, and nobody wanted to mess with him. So he brought that kind of respect also to it. But, you know, then it goes on. But this match here, Don Eagle was the AWA champion, not to be confused with the current, but the closest one in our lifetime. Vern Gagne's AWA. It was an AWA up in the Boston area that they had their own champion up there, and then of course But the thing that played the big role in this was TV expansion. Greg Kohler had that Chicago TV. A lot of people wonder why all these big matches, or even the one that we showed previously, was out of Chicago. And most of, you know, the Comiskey Park, the Wrigley Field and all that, they were all in Chicago, of course, but it was because of Fred Kohler's TV there and the power that they had. I mean, who was it? DeMont that had the TV system? Was that the guy's name?
Who's that?
DeMont.
DeMont, yeah. DeMont had the whole TV system, like TBS,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah. It was just like it was the first superstation we're saying first.
That's right.
And we'll get our hands slapped for saying first again. But it was the first superstation that come along. So all the wrestling talent was just like TV. All the wrestling talent wanted to come to Chicago and be on that Chicago TV and get that rub. Well, Kohler kind of played it down. Remember, he was a member of the NWA, but he worked with Al Half up in Boston. He worked with the Schwartz guy that was in Boston also. He worked with several different promoters around, and that's what was upsetting. And I think Kohler was the president. Yeah, too. Could be wrong on that at one time.
Yeah, and Schaft was the guy who was with Half up in Boston, who was moving into Chicago. So it was really an outlaw moving into a territory. The thing was, Schaft ended up getting ABC TV, and so the NWA then said it's an open territory because the guy had TV. It's a pretty rotten thing to do because, you know, they said rotten. They would always stick up for their guys. They didn't stick up for him. And they said, you got TV, so we're going to allow you to be NWA also.
And that's strictly because of TV. Once again, it shows you that our business was built on TV. And as you'll probably bring it up, you know, Gordis Dord and Milton Berle, if it hadn't been for those two, we probably would be doing this kind of stuff right now.
That's right. They called him Georgie Sets. He sold so many sets. He's claimed he sold more sets than Milton Berle. In fact, one of your neighbors down there in Tampa, John Capuya, or Capuya, I'm not sure how you pronounce his last name,
yes,
wrote this great book on Gordis George, and a lot of information came out of that. He was a retired professor down there at Tampa University.
Yeah, University of Tampa, yes, he was. And we both tried to reach out to the guy, and he's retired, and he's not taking any phone calls now. He missed his opportunity of fame.
A huge fame. That's right, huge fame. John could have
we
been
could probably sell another 1,000 books for him. We probably will. He'll probably wonder what did I get in this spike in these books for. But hold that book cover up there again. Let's give him his due because we did steal a lot of information from him.
We did. It's a terrific book on Gordis George he wrote. We sold a ton of books for Brian Blair.
And we're still selling books for Brian Blair, and he won't even take me to a free lunch. And
he's really cheap.
And I'm not wanting for a free lunch, you know.
That's awful. Awful.
Back surgery was awful.
You know, one of the original screw jobs, one thing, a commonality of this was Toots Mott. So there was the Gold Dust Trio back in the 1920s. It was Ed Stranger Lewis, Billy Sandow, and Toots Mott were the Gold Dust Trio. And Toots was the one that wanted to bring in sports entertainment into wrestling with Ed Stranger Lewis. Well, they had Wayne Munn, who was this huge 6'7" professional football player, really good looking guy, but not a shooter. And they wanted to put the title on him. Well, people that wanted to get at the Gold Dust Trio stuck Stanislaw Sabisco in there at he's 40 something years old, but a real shooter at 1925, and took the title off of it. No, literally just took the title off of it, which is different from, say, the screw jobs, you know, here and the other one that you orchestrated in Montreal, because that was a referee.
Why me?
That was a referee turning on the referee, just kind of double crossing the. Yeah, you're Mr. Screwjob.
Well, I learned it all. If you follow a little bit of that, hit Fred Kohler. You know who one of his partners were, don't you?
Who?
Jim Barnett.
No, that's right. Name? Yes, that's right. Yes.
Ring a bell? I mean. And so maybe I picked something up from Jim Barnett that I didn't know about, you know, how to do these things. But I was in business with Jim Barnett, and a screw job happened in Chicago when he first got into business. Then later on, another in he was out of the business. I believe he was. He could have still been working for WWF at the time, but I don't think so.
Yeah, and this screw job was very similar to, say, the Montreal one, because it wasn't a double cross. It wasn't a wrestler just hooking another guy and pinning him. It appears in this, and we'll go through it, that George and Don Eagle both may not have been in on it.
It appears that way, and you know, there was nobody come out the winner except for Fred Kohler.
That's right.
He was the only one that came out the winner of this. So, you know, I don't think either guy, myself, had anything to do with it or even knew it. If we, as we get into it, we can start. There's several things during the course of the match that I want to bring up and have people watch. And then at the end of it, you know, the second fall is the one that really is confusing to me on this.
Yeah. And they edited a lot of it out. It's not in any of the old tapes.
None. We both searched the internet far and wide. And we begged people to give us information on this thing. And we really appreciate the ones that did reach out to us, because yep, there's a couple of articles that I found and John found also that we couldn't find previously. So there's a lot of information to go over in this short match, but it's an iconic match, John, because it's something happened that wasn't planned to happen in our business.
That's exactly right. And who all was in on it, I don't think anybody will ever know. Because the only one that we know for sure was in on it was Fred Kohler and the referee.
Exactly.
And there's been accusations that even Don Eagle was in on it, which doesn't make any sense. And George was in on it, which, with history looking back, doesn't make any sense because he never wore the title.
He never wore the title, and he never benefited it. He got heat, from what I understand, you know, through some of the old timer. I was, you know, the great thing about doing the research that you're making me do on these old things, I'm finding out I'm older than I think I am, because, you know, hell, this happened a long time ago. But I start reading some of these guys' common opponents, Jesse James, and stuff. I was in the ring with these guys when I started a lot of these guys, you know. Holy cow. You know,
hey, by the way, Jack Pfeffer had something to do with this as well. Jack Pfeffer, you talk about crazy names, he would make guys' names very similar, like Luces instead of Luthez. You know, he would have all kinds of names that
Hobo,
would.
Hobo Brazil.
That's right. Hobo Brazil. That's right. Yeah, and Pfeffer was involved in this too. Pfeffer was one of the first ones to expose the business because he was mad at everybody else. These guys were like little children back then. They were all mad at each other and all trying to steal from each other.
That sounds familiar, doesn't it?
You think? And they, yeah, they talk about their being first in the business.
Yeah.
Well, you want to get started, Mr. Briscoe?
Yeah, I'm dying to get started.
Okay, we'll start on 3, 2, 1, go, okay?
Oh, no, don't wait. It would, okay, you gave me instruction. Now I got to get to it. It's been so long since we got there. Now, where did you go hide now?
And you're at zero, right? So we got 20 minutes to watch
John,
this
I'm
match.
A zero.
And okay. All of this is wait, on wait, our YouTube wait, channel.
What do you show on your deal? I show zero, but I also. What?
I show zero with the guy in the ring about to announce.
Yeah, that's what I show too.
And for all those out there, you know, please like and subscribe our YouTube channel. But also on our YouTube channel, we got all of these matches in the playlist, World's Greatest Most Iconic Matches. So are you ready, Mr. Briscoe?
No. Talk some more, John. I'm ready.
All right. 3, 2, 1, go. All right, we got Gorgeous George coming out. Hey, how great is Gorgeous George?
Look at the robes. You know the story behind the robes. He was good friends with Bob Hope, and he went out golfing one time with Bob Hope, and him and Bob Hope started talking, and Bob Hope invited him to the studio and took him back to wardrobe and told him, George, you need this.
Really?
And Bob Hope for one that turned him on to these fantastic robes. Human
that
or
is an awesome piece of, I'd never heard that.
Well, now you have, man.
You know, they must have golfed. You know where they golfed at? Bob Hope used to golf at that golf course right there in the middle of L.A. Nobody was ever in. It was very, very exclusive. So that's where they had to be.
I believe it was. And they were regular golfing mates. And Bob Hope and them were real, real tight friends. But Bob Hope So one that really gave him that showbiz look, you know, before he just had the jackets and the stuff like that, and Hope took him back to wardrobe and had to, I don't know if it's Universal or Fox or whichever one Bob Hope was associated with. They had a bunch of robes in there, and he said, take your pick.
That's awesome. You look at George here. I mean, Gorgeous George was George Wagner, grew up in Houston, and was a legit tough guy. But he didn't draw a dime until he became Gorgeous George.
Well, he didn't get tough in Houston. He got tough when he moved from Nebraska over to Iowa, and he started into amateur wrestling a little bit because he was in Iowa and he didn't want to get beat up all the time. So he started amateur wrestling from them. His folks were so poor that they decided to move out of that cornfield and move down to Houston, Texas, and they moved down to Houston.
Okay. And Don Eagle here was with his, if you see him here with the Mohawk, came out with his dad, War Eagle.
And War Eagle was a leader. He wasn't actually a chief at the time, but he was a leader of the Mohawk Nation. And when his son come along, he made him a chief.
Did you ever run into War Eagle? Because Don Eagle committed suicide.
I don't know. I never ran up. But you know the guys they train like that. That's another thing. That, you know, wow, Billy Two Rivers. I probably teamed up with Billy Two Rivers because he was a big star in the state of Oklahoma and for Leroy McGurk and all throughout the South when I was starting out.
And Don Eagle, you look at him here. He was a heck of a baby face, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was. That was the thing about Donnie. Look, he's really young at this time. I think he's in his early 20s now. I wanted to say 20, but I think he was like 21 or 22. He had just come out of a tremendous Golden Glove boxing career. The guy was Cleveland Golden Glove boxer. He's very athletic, and he does some moves in here. He does a handstand to that Indian deathlock that we'll show in the fall here coming up. But He was a very athletic guy and very, very personable, had that personality.
He had 20 professional fights, right?
He had 20, and I think he won 18 or 19 of them.
Yeah, something around that level. Had 20 fights. I mean, he was a legit tough guy.
Yeah, he's Cleveland Golden Glove champion, so he had to be pretty tough there, and. You see, the match is really not a standout match. It's not something, you know, that you could see, like the rating system, you know, this is the top match of the night or anything like this. It's a TV match, and their TV matches were 2 out of 3 falls, as were most matches were back in those days there. But it's kind of just a nondescript match until the finishes start coming.
Yeah, and here's what gets you about it. You know, you talk about the 5-star matches and all that stuff, which is great, you know, if you can do a 5-star match. George drew more money than anybody, and probably inflation-adjusted anybody in the history of the business, maybe. I mean, he drew tons of money from 47 to 1954. He was a good wrestler. He didn't wrestle when he drew money. He was Gorgeous George. He had the Georgie pins. He had the robes. He had his valet that came out with him. I mean, he got a lot of heat by not wrestling.
Exactly. And it was that Hollywood influence there. And as a lot of people know, Muhammad Ali got his spiel from Gorgeous George. Muhammad Ali copied him. Muhammad Ali saw him on TV one time during an interview and he said, I love that guy. He became friends with George. And also Liberace outfits and his attire and his walk through the piano all had to do with Gorgeous George Jr. So he was a cultural influencer, you know, back in his day. That's what's amazing about it. I was just talking to my son Joseph, and he said, you know, professional wrestling doesn't get enough credit for the cultural aspect of what they brought to the country. You know,
it was the same with James Brown. He credits Gorgeous George for his motivation as well. You know, the story with Ali is great. Ali, I think, was in his 8th fight in Las Vegas, and he'd heard about Gorgeous George, and he went to the Coliseum to watch it. I think it was George versus Classy Freddie Blassie. They had sold out the arena, and Ali had sold like 800 tickets. So like 800 to 15,000. And he said when he watched George walk out, he said he knew that was what he wanted to be. And he went back to the dressing room, and George laid out an entire plan for him. He said, listen, kid, you got great hands. I know who you are. You're going to be a great champion. He goes, but you got to tell him how pretty you are. You got to tell him how great you are. And he gave Muhammad Ali the blueprint for being Muhammad Ali. And Angelo Dundee, in a later interview, said this almost verbatim, that Ali gave 100% credit to Gorgeous George for that inspiration.
You're exactly right. I looked up that interview myself, and Dundee on there talking about the influence, the major influence that George had on him. So it's you know, and James Brown, I didn't know about James Brown, but I can see the character development that James Brown had also from Gorgeous George.
Well, you think about it, Jerry, you know, like during the Attitude Era, ratings were so high. So when you talk to wrestling fans that are a little bit older, they all remember the Attitude Era because everybody watched during that time. You had Stone Cold, The Rock, you had all these great characters, DX, everybody. Stooges. During this time, and of course the Stooges, Mr. Gerald Briscoe and Pat Patterson. But during this time, all you had was Milton Berle and Gorgeous George. So George influenced tons and tons of a generation of people.
Here, you see a little action.
This is it here, Jerry.
What's this move here? I mean, this is usually when you apply the Indian Deathlock, you're applying it with your legs, right?
That's right. Yeah, yeah.
But he applies it with his arms, John, and does an actual handstand for the win there. To me, my legs were so fat and muscular that I never could apply that Indian Deathlock. And I tried and tried and tried and tried. That was the first finish that Leroy McGurk told me to get. And I couldn't use it because my calves were too damn big. And, you know, it was hurting me more than it was hurting the other guy too, but it was hurting me more.
The Indian Deathlock, very few people use it now. You know, it's kind of an underneath figure four, and you can really work it, work the hold if you can get it on.
If you can get it on, and also, you know, I'll probably be called out on this, but I think Bret Hart's sharpshooter was kind of a deviation from the Indian Deathlock.
It certainly looks like it is, because that's how you hook the Indian Deathlock. I'd never seen it done with a handstand until I saw this tape. Have you ever seen it done with the arms and with the handstand? It's kind of like Charlotte Flair does with the figure eight now, going off the figure four.
No, I have not. That was the first time I'd ever seen the handstand. I mean, that just shows you the athletic ability of Eagle being able to do that. But you know what I wanted to bring up there? What's the rhythm of the referee's count on some of these false finishes, as we call them? He's got a steady, even count. And then we'll show you at the end of it, you know, what the count looks like.
It's a referee named Earl. You can't trust Earl, any referee named Earl.
What a coincidence, Earl and Earl.
This is Earl Mullahan or Monahan, referee.
Monahan, yeah.
And, of course, we're making fun of our dear friend, which we're not really making fun of him. He did what he was supposed to do.
Comparison.
You
can see both of these guys' athletic ability. That they both escape out of holds and all this, but see, Earl, as he drops in for a count, he's got that slow, consistent count. And that's right, John, that's what you want as a heel when you're on your back, is that count that you know that's a one.
That's right, because you've got to be able to.
Or even a fast referee. We've had fast one, two, three. I mean, you know, at least you know the rhythm of the count.
You got to be able to feel it. You know, George does a couple sit-outs here in a minute that are just amazing. It shows you what a great athlete he is.
And as we said, you know, he some of his formative years were spent in Iowa and as a junior wrestler, and you can tell that in here. And from what some of the reading I had, that you know, they had so much, Kohler had so much confidence, Kohler actually told him to go out and beat him.
You know, that's what Kohler said in his justice testimony. I don't know. I just wonder, Kohler. What's that?
The Department of Justice, you were sworn not to lie to those guys. I wouldn't lie to those guys.
You trust Kohler not to lie?
I don't trust anybody. I trust you not to lie to me because you're a real one. But, you know, they're just basically applying hold. This is a TV match, and, you know, so they're pacing themselves. But I want the fans to watch the rhythm count right there. They're the one, two. Now, he's not counting fast at all. His hands, you can visually see his hands go to one.
And George just sells this move that is absolutely worthless, and makes it look legit.
We're not campaigning for anybody to steal this move.
No, we're not. This is a horrible move. Horrible. It doesn't work. Nobody thinks it can work. And George is selling it for 2 minutes.
His arm out more than he was born with, as the announcer says. Tell me, his announcing is a little hokey, some of their sayings. But, you know, in 200 years from now, they'll probably be saying the same about Michael Cole. Well, we can say that about Michael Cole now.
That's right. Exactly. We'll gladly say it about him.
Don Eagle was a young, good-looking, athletic guy. One of the articles, and you read it too, that, you know, they took advantage of him because he was just another Native American, it says, just another.
Yeah,
Indian,
that's right.
You know, like.
Yeah, and they blamed it on him. He wanted to take time off to go hunting and fishing during the summer.
That was part of his contract. You know, they brought up Northern Canada also. You know, where his dad was. He was a hunting fisherman, just like a lot of like. You remember Mr. Perfect, Kirk, he wanted his time off to go hunting. When deer season come, he was going to get his week or so off to go hunting.
Here's George. Look at these sit-outs.
Even though they're working right there, that's hard to do. That's, you know, hard to do because the guy's weight is all on you, and it don't look good if the guy's off to the side of you. But George had that athletic ability, and Don had the knowledge to keep up with him and keep putting him in that position where he could spin.
You know, and this is something to bring up. You know, George was a pretty good athlete. When he did the stuff like that, it was to put his opponent over. Kurt Hennig was the same way. When Kurt Hennig would bump and do all this crazy stuff, it was to put his opponent over when he was a heel. And that's a big difference that a lot of mindset of young people have. Especially when they're heels, they'll do their fancy stuff, their great moves, to put themselves over. It's counterproductive when you're a heel.
Yeah. John, this is something here. We watched Pat O'Connor's Road Around. This was the second part of what I was saying. Somebody do that walk around that Pat did and end up in a short arm scissor. You can do these rows around it. In a minute here, he'll grab a short arm scissor and he'll row completely all four corners around the ring there. It looks so sweet. And then if you're a heel, you can always crank up on the thing. I did it that short arm scissors and roll around during my Starcade match with Youngblood and Steamboat, first Starcade. And then after I finished the row, I had Ricky. I said, Ricky, can you pick me up? And he got underneath, he squatted me and picked me up and suplexed me back and, of course, broke the hold there. But it was one of the highlights of the match, in my opinion, anyway.
Yeah, because people aren't used to somebody being picked up like that. Backlund used to do the same thing because he was so freaking strong.
That just takes strength galore to be able to pick somebody up. I was 220 at the time, and he just squatted me like I was nothing. But George, I mean, it's a typical match for its time there. You know, a lot of holds, a lot of back and forth. But you notice neither one of them are really pulling a lot of hair or pulling a lot of tights or healing their stuff like that. They're just being aggressive wrestling and working a little bit against the referee's orders.
And George was one of the first heels to do stuff like that.
Now, here we go. Now, this is where it gets confusing to me.
Yeah, I agree. He goes. He was selling his eye. He goes out of the ring. We're not sure what happens. He's chasing somebody around the ring, and then you're going to see an edit, and the match starts up in the next fall.
They're saying that George hit his head on the announce table as he went out. If it had been Michael Cole, he'd probably kicked him in the head. He would have. But Don hit his head on the way out, and then he stumbled off into the darkness there at the arena. And this is the simplicity of TV too, John. There's two cameras. There's a ringside camera and there's a hard camera. You know, and there's no handheld where you can chase the guys out in the audience. Like, you know, we wrestle all over the building. No cameras can get to it now. But
that's right. You know, the Von Erichs were one of the first, and you guys in Florida, one of the first 5 and 6 camera shoots. You know, before, this is why wrestling was one of the first things to put on television, like a late night talk show with Milton Berle, is because all you needed was really a hard cam and one other camera. It was easy to film.
And cheap.
Yeah, and cheap. And there's Don Eagle with his dad, War Eagle, right?
Yes. I guess he was a pretty accomplished wrestler in his time, too. Don Eagle, it was a rarity at that time for Native American wrestlers. And he was one of the first really big time. And then the guys that he trained went on to become big stars, like Two Rivers and some of the other guys that he trained along the way there.
Hey, fellas, you're out of.
Sometimes things never change. It will out of gal, Jared Vince hates.
And there's the typical baby face spot. Yeah. Firing up after the heel cheats.
And Bill him out.
It's just funny, the Bill throws. You know, nobody lands flat. Yeah. I guess because those rings were just so freaking hard.
Oh, man, those rings that I came up in. And watch this right here. We're going to talk over an important part here. Did you see that? It was 1, 2, then a pause, and a 3.
Yep.
And his shoulder, if we did, shame that, you know, they didn't have replays, but his shoulder was, to me, was clearly up too.
And Don Eagle's going crazy here.
Yeah. Watch him punch the referee. Now, bear in mind, this is a Golden Glove boxer, and he punching the referee, and the referee didn't even go down. So, you know, that's the reason. Well, you know, was he working the punches when he was hitting the referee?
Yeah, you're right, because Don Eagle could hit a defenseless referee and knock him out. He had 20 pro fights. That's why people thought Don Eagle might have been in on it. You know, he ripped his shirt off. That looks like a work. You know, might not have been. You know, maybe Don Eagle was just hesitant. But you look at George right after the bell. They went to raise his hand. He rips his hand down. But now, in fairness, so did Sean in Montreal. So if George was in on it, that's what he would do if he didn't want people to know he's in on it. But the way history plays out, it looks like George was not in on it.
Yeah, there was no celebration. There was nothing, you know. I mean, it's just, you know, and there's no, if you'll notice, there's no belt presentation. So who came out the winner of this thing? Because there's no belt, even though Eagle was the AWA champion, and he just lost it. But it wasn't announced a title match. So was it a title match? That part we still don't know, you know, because he wasn't presented and he was never announced as the AWA champion.
And the AWA title was never mentioned in the commentary.
Never.
You know, the referee hauls ass out of there. Don Eagle's behind him. George is still in the ring. I think George is waiting for security to clean a lane for him, because watch when he tries to leave.
And they're getting pelted with debris at this time, too. And the ring announcer, he picks up the microphone, and then he sets it down, and he gets the heck out of Dodge, you know, because he don't want to get that stuff thrown on him anymore. And they're kind of, watch a fan grab George's robe as he's stepping.
Yeah. And you look at it, there's George's valet going out first.
And George ended up the worst of. George ended up with a split mouth, and you can see.
Yeah, watch George as he gets out of the ring.
Yeah, right there. You're fighting your way out, and the cops are helping him get out of that too. So, is it or was it? Was it or was it not?
Here's what I believe. After reading everything that we've gotten and seeing all that we've watched, I think the only one in on it was Fred Kohler and the referee. Obviously, the referee was in on it because that count was so hokey and so bad. The referee was obviously in on it, and Fred Kohler was obviously in on it. I don't think George was, and I don't think Don Eagle was.
I tend to agree with you. I don't think either one of the guys in the ring was in on it. I really strongly believe that the only two that could have pulled it off is the referee and Fred Kohler. And Fred Kohler actually said, you know, because everybody was saying fast count. It wasn't a fast count. No. It wasn't, because there was that hesitation. He said that he even had the which later on. Don Eagle was fined, what, at that time, $50,000 for striking a referee.
Was it that high? I couldn't remember how high it was. He was fined.
It was around $50,000, maybe in today's time. But they said they put a clock on the film and timed it out, and it was a 3-second count.
No way. No. I think he lied like crazy. I think what he did was he got one of the commissioners to back him up if the Justice Department ever called him. And he absolutely just lied about that.
Yeah. There were no winners off of this except for Kohler, and Kohler actually didn't even. And a few months later, the whole premise of this thing was Kohler was getting opposition in Chicago, and a guy ended up with TV, and the guy was a non NWA member. Was it ABC TV or something like
that? Yeah, he got ABC TV. ABC
TV, the board of directors, and the board of directors voted him in as a member of the NWA.
So you had, coming up after this, you had Don Eagle against Thez. And this was not, I think this was not a Kohler promotion. Either way, it was going to benefit Shop and Half, the two guys that he was against in Chicago. That got canceled because of this. So that's why, obviously, this benefited Kohler. Well, then George came back and wrestled Fez in Chicago and put him over in straight falls. You know, George didn't care to put guys over. George didn't have to win titles. George was drawing a ton of freaking money. He didn't care. He came back and put Fez over. But when Fez got put over, there was no mention of the AWA title.
Right, that's a great point, too. George did not need a title. You know, there's been a guy, The Rock didn't need a title. You know, there's a certain guys that are business. Sure, it's good to say, maybe give them the title once for former world champion or something like that. But George was so popular, and it wasn't just Chicago. George was popular nationwide. I mean, we can go back and chart the history of George. You know, he was up in Oregon working as himself there, and nothing was happening. He wasn't over, you know, and then because he was a wrestler, you know, and not the flamboyant guy that he turned into be there. So
I think it was around 1953. I may have my dates wrong, Joe DiMaggio, the captain of the New York Yankees, was making, I think, $105,000 or something like that. Anyway, Gorgeous George made the same amount. Now, later, Buddy Rogers said Gorgeous George made $9 million in 7 years. That seems like an exaggeration, but making $100,000 a year then, that was more than the best Major League Baseball player in the world was making. I mean, George was basically the highest paid athlete in the world at that
not
time.
Not only athlete, I think he was the highest paid citizen in the United States at that time.
It's unbelievable. That's why he didn't need a title. That's why he didn't care. I mean, he come in and put Fez over in 2 straight falls because he knew he had heat.
You hear so much about Gorgeous George, but one thing you've never heard is his arrogance about doing business with people. He didn't have any hang-ups on anybody. He knew what he was. He knew he was an attraction. He was there to get guys over and help them draw money so he could make a return match and make even more money. So I never, in my career that spans back into the mid-60s, ever heard a bad thing about Gorgeous George had an ego where he wouldn't put guys over. He wouldn't work for certain promoters because they screwed him on his pay. But he never refused, as far as I know him. Like I said at the beginning of this, realizing how old it is, I shared the ring with a lot of these guys that, you know, that was on the tail end of their careers when George was active in the business. So I always heard a lot of talk about him, and a lot of praise of George, and there was a lot of jealousy at that time, but you never heard that George was hard to do business with.
Yeah, and George was one of those guys, you know, that he brought in as an attraction and would come in and out of different territories, but they never wanted to put the NWA title on him, which might have been a really good idea. The guy had so much heat, but a lot of promoters did not like his effeminate character. They thought it was something that was not right for wrestling and blah, 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 blah. Buddy Rogers said the same thing. He thought it was a cardinal sin. Yeah,
Buddy Rogers was labeled the same way there. You know, they were.
That's right. And Buddy Rogers later said George was just ahead of his time. So Rogers thought the same thing back then. But then later with history and a little bit, you know, bit of time lapse, he said George was right. He said George was just ahead of his time. Yeah. You know, it's funny because you look at shooters. And shooters never mind doing silly stuff or non-shooting stuff. You know, Santino from Canada, he was quite a shooter. I mean, he legit.
So good, man.
He did all the hokey stuff. He told me one time, he said, you know, it's funny. I'm actually a guy that can wrestle, and I don't wrestle. And that's how I draw money. You know, George was the same way. George was a tough guy, and he played a sissy, you know, according to his character. But he didn't mind it because he knew he was tough, and he was making a ton of money doing it.
Yeah, it to me too, and it's just tragic, you know, the way George's life ended too, you know, as an alcoholic and broke. Is a couple of the promoters out in L.A. Paid for part of his funeral, and I saw the interview. Did you see the interview with his ex-wife, with his wife, his valet?
I think I have, yes. I haven't seen it recently. Yeah, well,
she said, I'm sick of the guy getting the credit for it. He said, George's funeral was so elaborate. She said, they kicked in $2,000, $1,000 a piece. She said, the rest of it, I had to work double shifts in a bar that was dying to pay for the funeral expenses there. So it's just a tragic, you know, things like that wouldn't have happened nowadays. And, you know, people would have taken care of George's expenses.
Yeah, you know, George went back, I think, in round 63 or something, one of his last matches, and did a hair match in the Coliseum. You know, by that time, he had gotten fat. You know, he had problems with booze. And by that time, he was way, way past his prime, just kind of did it to make a little bit of money. You know, it was tragic, you're right, because George would have been a guy, much like I think like Buddy Rogers, maybe even more so, where he'd have been around professional wrestling for the next 40 years, because he was so entertaining and so far ahead of his time.
Yeah, and we've already talked about the influences outside the ring that Gorgeous George had. How about the influences in the ring that Gorgeous George had? The Ric Flairs and you know, even the Harley Races. You can and a lot of those guys, you know, there's a lot of showmanship that George and you know, spawned Gorgeous George Jr., Gorgeous George III, Gorgeous George Grant. I mean, there was just a plethora of Gorgeous Georges after he passed, and so he inspired was a big influence on so many of our guys in the business during the 60s and 70s. You know, just trying to get the rub and then the bleach blonde, you know, just started getting more popular. You know, the Ray Stevens, Pat Patterson, and the guy Hollywood blonde and the Bollywood blonde. You know,
George tried several different things. At one point, he tried dyeing his hair to match his robes, and it really didn't work. So he dyed his hair blue to match his blue robe, pink to match a pink robe, red robe. George tried all kinds of things, which nobody at that time was willing to try because people thought it was bad that he was playing a character like that.
Well, let me tell you what he also did. He had a Cadillac, and he had a special painted orchid. And so Gorgeous George Jr. bought him a Cadillac Eldorado, brought it to Briscoe Brothers Body Shop, and told us to paint it like Gorgeous George's Eldorado.
Really?
I said, what's that? He said, orchid, don't you know? I said, no. So we painted our painter said, you want me to paint that brand new Cadillac Eldorado orchid? So we stripped that baby down and we painted it orchid. It was the sweetest looking thing you ever seen, man.
The toast of the coast, the human orchid. He was one of the first to have all the catchphrases. He's one of the first to have the great entrance. I mean, George was really way, way ahead of his time.
And Don Eagle, poor guy, I guess he was quite a businessman also when he ended his life with a gunshot wound, you know, later on in his life, I think in the early 60s or mid 60s or sometime around there.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Opportunity to meet him, but he had some business deals. that were on reservational deals, the thing, and he was actually a Mohawk Indian, you know, the tribe migrated, his branch of the tribe migrated to Canada where things were better and got more property up there. But he was a legit Indian, and he only trained Native American blood, Native Americans that were, you know, he wouldn't train anybody else. But he was a good businessman, and he was in on a couple of reservation jobs that the tribe would give to him because it's cheap. Don Eagle, you know, famous American wrestler, and just the power of the TV, the opportunity he got. But a couple of deals started going sour on him, and I guess the weight of it was just too much for him, and he ended his life.
Yeah, and you look at the fallout of this, nobody benefited from this except Kohler. You know, I guess the referee probably got a lifetime job from Kohler, but couldn't be used anywhere else. Nobody could trust it. But Don Eagle never recognized there was a title change. So Don Eagle lost the big match with Fez coming up in Chicago, but he got it back later. It did hurt him for a while. And George took his place with Fez, did the job in Two Falls, never mentioned the title. George never talked about this his entire life. This was not a big deal to George. George, that's why I don't think George was in on it. Don Eagle wasn't in on it. I think it was just Kohler trying to get it Shaft and Haft or Schaft or Schwartz, whatever his name was, the guy who had the ABC TV, who was running Outlaw against him. Schwartz, the only one that was in on it.
Yeah. But that just shows you that, you know, politics remain the same, no matter how many years we are. I mean, they're the same. Somebody's got something I wanted, you know, and that's what this was basically all about. It was sharing talent, and it was trying to, you know, you be the alpha dog here and the business there. And there were that triplets that didn't, you know, the other two guys wanted their share too. Then all of a sudden, you know, here's Sam over in St. Louis, you know, and the results of this thing, probably the only ones that benefit on it was the same ones that benefit on all the deals as a wrestling fan, because they talked Lou into coming out of retirement, who had retired much too early at that time. And there were champions springing up all over. And as we know, when you got a multiple world champions, who is the world champion? Well, that's one thing that Lou brought to the table was I'm the world champion. And so they talked Lou into coming out, and he beat George, and he beat for the AWA or Wichita title or one of the titles.
That was the AWA, but it wasn't on the AWA line.
And then they got rid of that.
He came out later. He came out later also, you know, in the match we went over last week in 61 with Pat O'Connor and Buddy Rogers.
So he got rid of all the titles that were floating around in other territories, and was able, when Thez came in, able to put it under that one umbrella, you know. And even Vince Sr. was a member of the NWA. Even though Vince Sr. off of this match here, I think shortly after when he got Bruno to win.
Not shortly after. That was after last. That was after the Pat O'Connor, Buddy Rogers.
Okay.
Yeah, this was when
I got you on there because you're a hell of a lot smarter than that.
You know, in 1956 was the Justice Inquiry, and that's when Fred Kohler did this interview that we're talking about. And after that, the New York Commission wouldn't let wrestling be called matches. They had to be called exhibitions. So if you listen to some of the early WWF and WWWF tapes, they call the matches exhibitions. And that came off the 1956 Justice Inquiry into the legitimacy of professional wrestling, but more importantly, it was about the monopoly that the NWA had.
Exactly. And during that article, a lot of stuff that come out of that article was our old friend Jack Pfeffer that was supplying the information there. And that's the reason Pfeffer was outlawed, was blackballed from our business the way he was. And I know you're not supposed to use the word blackballed anymore, but he was thrown out of the NWA and never again associated with it, but he thrived on creating these G.G. Rogers and Hobo Brazils and guys.
Right. Well, Mr. Briscoe, we did us another one.
It's amazing that we got through this one here, man. That's obsolete as my equipment is here.
one of the greatest, most iconic matches of all time. Gorgeous George versus Don Eagle in Chicago, with all kinds of ramifications at stake and all types of curiosity to this day about who was in on it and who wasn't.
Guys and girls out there, do your research. And if John and I, actually, we don't mind being wrong. We got some of our facts wrong. We're just like you. We want to know the truth out there. So if anybody's got any information that we hadn't been able to dig up, I mean, we even traced a guy down in South America to get some information from. And we left nothing unturned, in my opinion, but I know we missed something out there. So please inform us, please enlighten us. If whatever our mistakes was, we're willing, we're not grouchy, we're not some of these other guys that do these podcasts and get all thinking about it. We want to know we're wrong, and I'm sure you'll tell us.
Yeah, please tell us, leave it in.
We want to know where we were wrong and what was the truth out of it.
Yep, and we'd love to correct it. So leave your comments in the comment sections or on our Twitter. We'd love to hear from you. If you got any information, or if you disagree with us or think something's wrong, please let us know. We'd love to hear it. So, but thank you for joining us. This is Stories of Briscoe and Bradshaw. Best of the best. Don't forget to like and subscribe for the world-famous Mr. Gerald Briscoe and myself, Bradshaw. Thanks for joining us.